Previously on Beta.
I'm sure this will work out fine.
Oh, so am I. I already like you. And when I spoke to Satan this morning before breakfast, he pretty much guaranteed this would be a great experience.
You guys are being selfish.
Well, I've been wrong before, brother. You know, I know I said you would never be nothing, but, you know. Now I gotta eat my words,
I said
right?
The same thing about you, and I was true.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Lorraine Newman revisits her life in Studio 8H, Rockefeller Center, where she performed live from New York on Saturday Night Live.
When he described it to me, you know, he said it was a replacement for Carson reruns on Saturday nights, and it was only going to be 13 weeks with a five-year option. And I remember thinking, like, that'll ever happen?
Oh, it happened, Lorraine. It happened. 46 years later, SNL is still on the air. It's going to outlive us all. Also coming up on today's show, cultural critic Hanif Abdurraqib explores the history of Black performance in America, including the unique qualities of the Black funeral.
I think that was maybe the first time I saw dance and song kind of collide in a way that felt celebratory in the sense of grief.
But first, double life of Bill Oakley. If he's not writing comedy scripts for TV shows like The Simpsons and Portlandia, chances are pretty good that he's delivering fast food reviews that make people's mouths water. Bill has been dubbed the Gordon Ramsay of fast food. Does that mean that Gordon Ramsay is the Bill Oakley of slow food? We'll have to get back to you on that. Bill Oakley made his mark during his time as a writer and showrunner, nay, executive producer, for The Simpsons. He's the one who came up with the idea for most meta Simpsons episodes ever. The one with Homer's arch enemy, Frank Grimes, or Grimy as he liked to be called. Bill also wrote the steamed ham episode, which 20 years later has become a meme. We caught up with Bill at his home office in Portland, Oregon to find out how he launched his comedy career.
The coin of the realm in TV writing is writing a spec script, which means writing a sample episode of a show that you like for free and showing it around to show that you can write. We hadn't had much luck for about 4 years. And finally, someone told us to get real and write a really good script for a show that we loved. Seinfeld had just come out. It was called The Seinfeld Chronicles. So it had only been on for a few episodes. And we were like, okay, well, nobody's seen this show, but it's hysterical. And we will write an episode of it. And we did. And it basically got us through the door. It got us like 10 or 12 meetings at places like Cheers and Murphy Brown and places like that. And also The Simpsons. It got us Mike Reese and Al Jean at The Simpsons. At that time, I don't think one of them had never even heard of Seinfeld, read it and thought it was funny and decided to assign us an episode to write. And that was the beginning of how this whole thing started.
You and your writing partner, Josh Weinstein, were appointed to be executive producers and showrunners for the 7th and 8th seasons of The Simpsons. What were your visions for the kinds of episodes that you wanted to create?
Honestly, we just wanted to copy season 3, because season 3 was run by Mike Reese and Al Jean, who were the guys who hired us, who were geniuses. And I believe that season 3 of The Simpsons is the best season of any TV show of all time. And by the way, we didn't work on that, so it's not like blowing my own horn. And so we were just like, when we took over, we were like, let's make this like season 3. And we kind of reverse engineered season 3. Said, okay, well, it had 2 Lisa episodes, 1 Sideshow Bob episode, 1 Itchy and Scratchy episode, you know, X number of emotional episodes. And we kind of just mapped it out from there using our staff and our love of the show, try to concoct a season, for at least for season 7, that kind of echoed season 3. For season 8, we decided to be a little more experimental because at that point we were like, you know, this is one of the wrongest things that anyone ever thought, but we were pretty sure the show was going to be over in by season 9 or 10. Because sitcoms don't go that long. Cheers, MASH, all those ones, they were all over by season 9 or 10.
So same with Seinfeld, yeah.
Yeah, so we figured that this show would be over. So we were like, let's just have all the fun we can have with this thing before it runs out of steam. So in season 8, we were just kind of like, we want to do all the craziest ideas, all the stuff we always wanted to do, and then we will leave because this thing is not going to be around much longer. And now, of course, here we are, it just got renewed for season 34.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Yeah. One of the greatest episodes, in my opinion, that was made while you and Josh were in charge was Homer's Enemy. What's the origin story behind this one?
That's another one that was like, let's just go for it. Homer's enemy was my idea, but all of my idea was, let's give him an enemy. So I was like, let's come up with a story about a guy who is the polar opposite of Homer and what happens. And then we took it to the writer's room and John Swartzwelder. We all kind of mutually came up with this thing about Frank Grimes. And the thing about the Frank Grimes story is that Frank is a humorless fellow and he pays the ultimate price. You can't tamper with the Simpsons universe and you can't question it.
And what do you have to show for your lifetime of sloth and ignorance?
What?
Everything! A dream house, two cars, a beautiful wife, a son who owns a factory, fancy clothes, and lobsters for dinner! And do you deserve any of it? No!
What are you saying?
I'm saying you're what's wrong with America, Simpson. You coast through life, you do as little as possible, and you leech off decent, hardworking people, like me. If you lived in any other country in the world, you'd have starved to death long ago.
He's got you there, Dad.
Yeah, exactly. It's so, as you touched on there, it's such a meta episode because the presence of Frank, it really undermines the Simpsons universe. And how is Homer still employed? How does he have this beautiful house, this beautiful wife, and right. a son who owns a factory? Because that other storyline is that Bart buys the factory, and I love that line. How did fans react to this episode?
I don't know. TV is so different now that you have Twitter and you have the online world. But in whenever 1996 or 7, when that was broadcast, you had Usenet news groups, you had alt.tv.simpsons where people commented on The Simpsons, except they hated everything. They hated everything since season 3. So after a certain point, we stopped reading that. And also TV critics, you know, a TV critic might review your show once a year, but they didn't usually review shows that were in their 7th or 8th season. So we never got any feedback from anybody. The only thing we ever heard, we got one letter from a viewer, a guy who was in the army working at like a supply depot, who said, "You guys nailed it. The whole world is filled with stupid morons like Homer." The guy loved it and appreciated it because apparently he was living the life of Frank Grimes. So we put that up on the wall and we all enjoyed that one guy's response to it. But that was the only thing we heard for 20 years.
Hmm. Yeah. You're also responsible for the steamed ham sketch that originally aired in 1996 in an anthology episode called 22 Short Films About Springfield. 20 years later, steamed hams became a meme. How did that happen?
That was exciting. So when we did 22 Short Films, everybody got to write a sketch for their favorite character. And I called Chalmers and Skinner. And Skinner had burned his roast, trying to pass. It's an old, you know, goes back to the days of radio or vaudeville, a sketch where the boss is coming to dinner and something goes wrong. And Skinner's trying to pass off his burned hamburgers from a fast food restaurant as his own cooking.
You know, these hamburgers are quite similar to the ones they have at Krusty Burger.
Oh, no. Patented Skinner Burgers. Old family recipe.
For steamed hams.
Yes.
Yes. And you call them steamed hams, despite the fact they are obviously grilled.
This is not a traditional joke-filled Simpsons thing. It's actually rather joke-free. It's just it's a build, and it's kind of a sketch that, you know, maybe like some certain Monty Python sketches where it just gets more preposterous. Anyway, and then it became kind of an internet thing two decades later. And I think what happened is that the way I've been able to trace it back in a couple articles was that people in Australia, there's a lot of Simpsons fans in Australia, started calling the supermarket chain they have called Woolworths and asking for steamed hams as a joke. And then they started to play along with it. And they made these videos about steamed hams and they put up signs in their grocery stores that says, "We don't sell steamed hams, but we do have ground beef that you're going to love." And then things started to take off from there. It became a thing. And that was probably between 2014 and 2018. And by 2018, it had peaked. It became meme of the year, according to people who keep records of such things for 2018. And people remixed it. There's hundreds of remixes on YouTube. Many absolutely brilliant.
Seymour! Who pretended I was just stretching my calves on the windowsill? Isometric exercise.
Seymour! Why is there smoke coming out of your oven, Seymour?
No, not even smoke. It's steam. Steam from the steam clams we're having. Steam clams.
And it was thrilling for me because I didn't know if anybody even liked this thing to begin with. That's the story of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You pay homage to steamed hams with your new side hustle as a fast food critic. Your annual awards are called the Steamies. And you post videos of your reviews on Instagram and Twitter. Why did you decide to start reviewing fast food?
You know, it's interesting. I did not really start. I've been doing it all my life. I just didn't put it on Instagram. Okay. And I've always been very interested in fast food, probably early because I was probably so deprived of it as a kid, because they just, when I grew up, they didn't have fast food restaurants everywhere. And it was a real treat to be driven 60 miles to McDonald's. So I've been interested in fast food. I talked about it with my family and my friends, and then I started talking about it on Twitter. And the turning point came in 2018 when McDonald's decided they were going to release these new fresh beef quarter pounders. And I went to try them. I was just going to tweet a pros review of them. But then I was like, why don't I just film on my phone? And it was really popular. And so I just kept doing it.
You describe yourself as the Gordon Ramsay of fast food. Does this mean that Gordon Ramsay is the Bill Oakley of good comedy served quickly?
You know, that, first of all, Gordon Ramsay is actually a very talented chef. And I'm not, it's just not, I didn't dub myself the Gordon Ramsay. That was The Wrap, which is a
oh, okay, right.
Tell me that.
Yeah.
So okay. It's not entirely accurate, but the thing that Gordon Ramsay is known for is obviously is being brutally frank. And sometimes kind of humorous in his derision. And I think that's where I become a Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, it was such a clever epithet, description I thought for sure you would have come up with it. But the rap can be witty too, yeah. You've tried a lot of food from a place where I've spent too many years, the province of Manitoba in Canada. What's your impression of Manitoba cuisine?
You know, first of all, I'd say it's probably mainly about the potato chips. Canadian potato chips are really something else, and there's so many varieties, so many regional varieties all across Canada that we never get here in the U.S. And that's why even in the Steamies this year, I had a special category just for Canadian potato chips delivered by Jay Baruchel, famous Canadian comedian.
Right.
And I would say what stands out in my mind specifically is that I think Winnipeg stands at the intersection of a number of different regions in terms of the potato chips. Like, they get a number of different ones. And the Manitoba honey dill sauce is possibly the best condiment I've ever had.
Yeah, I tried that one when I was last in Winnipeg, I guess a little over a year ago, and it is really good. Why did that win Condiment of the Year?
It's weird that this is a condiment that is so regional that it's not even available outside of Manitoba, much less in America. Somebody told me about it. I have a number of followers from that region, and somebody told me that I had to try it, and I ordered it for like $25 a jar, you know, to be shipped here, and it blew me away. The sauce is marketed as a chicken finger dipping sauce. It's only for dipping chicken nuggets or chicken fingers in, although you can use it for many things. That's how they market it. So I did it, and it's so good. I just can't believe everybody's not eating it all the time, and it's not become a standard condiment that you get at McDonald's with your chicken nuggets, because it's sweet. And it has kind of a thick honey texture to it, but the dill gives it a certain unusual spiciness that really makes it noteworthy. And like, man, every time I make chicken nuggets, that is all I want, is just to dip them, every one of them, in Manitoba honey dill sauce.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, people send you packages of food. What is the most pleasant surprise you've received?
I've gotten so many things from generous fans all over the world. I would say, honestly, the most surprising thing I ever received is a bunch of fancy ice from Minnesota. That the Minnesota manufacturer of really fancy ice, and by fancy ice, I mean the kind that's used in really fancy, expensive cocktails that is totally clear. The manufacturer of this ice sent me a big box of Minnesota treats along with several bags of his ice, which made the journey without melting. And there were ice cubes. There's cubes that were big, and there were spheres that were like shards, and I've never had such great ice. So that was a surprise.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and they weren't flavored. They weren't flavored ice or anything. Yeah. 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 You're working now as the head writer and executive producer on season 3 of an HBO Max animated series called Close Enough. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. This show is created and run by J.G. Quintel, who is an animation genius and created the show Regular Show, which ran on Cartoon Network for probably about 10 years. And I had worked with him a little bit on Regular Show back in the very earliest days. And I had worked with him on this show back in its very earliest days as well. It's a very surreal. If you ever saw Regular Show, it's extremely surreal. This show takes that same sensibility and animation style, but grounds it a little bit more it's about a family. It's about a young family and also their divorced best friends who happen to live with them to save money on rent. And the show deals with a lot of It deals with kind of relatable problems of being a young parent, but it always kind of spirals into surrealness in a really funny way.
Oh, the Bruins bar.
Yeah, from the night we first met.
I thought you were so hot. When you said hi, I saw fireworks.
Let's reminisce a little faster.
What the hell? Our divorce papers? You said you sent these over a year ago.
I must have gotten distracted. You know, we're in a golden age of TV.
So we're still married? You need to let go and sign these.
So I was delighted when I got a call to ask if I'd be interested in returning to the show to be head writer and executive producer for season three. Now, that said, to be JG makes all the calls, but I'm the head writer. I supervise the writing.
So beyond Close Enough and also continuing to your work as doing fast food criticism, do you have things that you want to do?
I have four other projects that I'm working on for my next my next job after Close Enough. The primary one of which is a spinoff of the show Mission Hill. That show was our greatest success and our greatest failure, and that it was a show that was completely our vision, but it was canceled after two episodes. But then it ran on Adult Swim over and over for 10 straight years, where it built up this cult following, I guess I'd say. So what we have is a show that is a spinoff of the show. It's essentially the same show, just with a few differences, that we've been working on for about a year, and we are going to take it out to buyers very soon. Hopefully someone will buy it. And then we have a couple other shows too. I have a couple other shows I've been working on that I'm all excited about, not all of which are animated. And I'm also going to start manufacturing vinyl toys starting.
Oh, really?
Real soon. Oh, cool. Yes. It sounds like I'm real busy, but in fact, most of these projects have been in gestation for three straight years, and they all just happened to be coming together this month.
Oh, cool. Bill Oakley, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Bill Oakley is a comedy writer, fast food reviewer, creator of memes, and a vinyl toy manufacturer. You can find out more about Bill at wpr.org/beta.
I just never imagined that I could write a book. So that, I think, is really a major thing that I learned about myself, is that I could.
Coming up, actor, comedian, and writer Lorraine Newman, one of the original Not Ready for Primetime players on Saturday Night Live. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Lorraine Newman is one of the original cast members of Saturday Night Live. She's also a founding member of the legendary improv group, The Groundlings. More recently, she's pivoted to a successful career as a voice actor. Lorraine has used her versatile voice to bring many animated characters to life in TV and movies. She revisits her life and career in a new audio memoir called May You Live in Interesting Times. We caught up with her in her Los Angeles home and kicked off the conversation by asking about what she describes as her bottomless need for attention.
I think I was one of four kids. My parents were not very involved, so I really had to work my ass off to get any kind of attention at all. And I think it's a pretty common story. People kind of go out in the world and try to make up for that in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you were 19, you were accepted into the CalArts theater program, but you left a short time later to join an improv workshop with your sister Tracy. And this improv workshop evolved into the Groundlings. What do you remember most about your Groundlings experience?
It was a very exciting build to actually being a legit company, even though by the time I left to do SNL, it was still in relatively new. But we were the only game in town in terms of an improv company. And we started to get a following and reviewed by the LA Times and other legit newspapers. So that was very exciting. And it was exciting to go from being just a workshop to a real company.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn about yourself from studying improvisation?
That I'm better off writing monologues. I'm not the greatest improviser. There are a lot of people, of course, I've seen that are just staggering. And those are people that can come up with funny stuff in the moment. I'm usually, I contribute to the idea moving forward. but I'm not necessarily funny. That's why I chose to do characters, because I had a chance to think about what I was doing, to write and craft my pieces so that I could try to be funny in a different way.
Yes, and one of the character monologues you created was a valley girl named Sherry. Can you tell us a bit about Sherry?
That came out of just observing the fact that there was a really certain kind of speech I noticed amongst people I went to school with and my twin brother's friends that he went surfing with. And this I started to observe like in the 60s when I was still in high school. And I've always been fascinated with dialects anyway. And it was just an amalgam of a friend that I went to school with. Just kind of, there was a sweetness to the character, kind of born of their lack of awareness, shall we say.
Like, my boyfriend Brad and I were just really falling apart. You know, we had this really nice relationship. We were going to get married and everything. And, well, like, he installed stereo systems and customized fans, you know. And all he ever talked about was woofers and tweeters and push-pull rods, man. And it was really boring. It really grossed me out royal.
My fellow Canadian Lorne Michaels saw you perform with the Groundlings twice. And after that second time, he asked you to meet him at his hotel. He was staying at the Chateau Marmont. Can you tell us about this meeting?
Well, I'm thinking, I guess that was the first time I'd ever gone there. And we met out at the pool. So there was just like a, you know, one of those umbrellaed tables with chairs and everything. And as I'm walking past the pool to where we're sitting, I see like David Warner and Lauren Hutton, all these kind of famous people just sunning themselves. And then we sat down and I had become friends with him at this point. So I really had no idea what he was going to talk to me about. I mean, I figured it was a show because that's my initial encounter with him. But when he described it to me, you know, he said it was a replacement for Carson reruns on Saturday nights. And it was only going to be 13 weeks with a 5-year option. And I remember thinking, like, that'll ever happen.
So you moved to New York City, and what was that first season of SNL like for you?
Well, it was a period of adjustment. It was adjusting to living in New York. I was robbed when I got there. Oh, I had driven cross-country with everything I had, including my written material from the Groundlings, and that was all taken away. I just had the clothes on my back. That was it. And like a little overnight case because I was like in a hotel. That was disorienting to say the least. And getting to know, you know, everybody, although Gilda was my first friend and really kind of squired me around and introduced me to all her friends, which was so nice of her. But it was adjustment trying to figure out how to get airtime, to get writers to get your characters and maybe write for them. It was different than what it was at the Groundlings because I wrote with my sister, and so I had an automatic writing partner who really knew what I could do, and I was without that.
Yeah. You later discovered that you weren't the only one experiencing these feelings of fear and anxiety during that first year. Your fellow cast members were also dealing with these emotions. How different do you think things could have been if you had all confided in each other at the time while it was going on?
Oh, wow. That's an interesting question. I don't know. I think it might have been better for all of us if we, you know, I think that's what fellowship is all about, you know, knowing that you're not the only one.
Yeah. The first time you performed your Sherry the Stewardess character on SNL was in a sketch called Godfather Group Therapy with that week's host, Elliot Gould. Can you tell us a bit about this sketch?
Well, they kind of just plugged in my monologue from The Groundlings, except one of the most well-known lines from it was written by them, which was, "Vito, you're blocking." I thought it was just a great premise, and I was thrilled to have a chance to do something that I felt confident with.
So I knew I had had a bitchin' body and a good personality. So, you know, I just left town and I became a stewardess, you know. And then I grew so much emotionally, I couldn't believe it. Because, like, I went back to Encino and everybody seemed so immature. It was unreal, you know. You know, doctor, I think that Norman Mailer is right. You can't go home.
Okay.
John Belushi did a great Marlon Brando impression, and so did Peter Boyle. So when Peter guest hosted, everyone was brainstorming about Brando's sketch ideas. What did you suggest?
Well, we were all kind of gathered about home base, which is where the hosts do their monologues. And it was a rehearsal day, and they were kind of, you know, coming up with premises, you know, like Planet of the Brandos. And everybody was just pitching these things. And I kind of just absently, I swear to God, I don't even know where this came from, but I just absently said Dueling Brandos. And so that was it. That's how that happened.
I could have been a contender. I could have been someone instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it, Charlie. I could have been Senator Corleone, Governor Corleone. There wasn't enough time, Michael.
Yeah, that's gold, Lorraine. Gold.
That's why, really if I good. Hadn't been there, they would have come up with it within two days rather than one.
No, that's the Lorraine Newman touch. Nobody else could have come up with that, I don't think. What is your proudest accomplishment on Saturday Night Live?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it depends on the day you ask me, because I don't really feel, and I write about this in the book, that I had too many shining moments, but... You know, there were certainly a lot of moments where I was handed something and it didn't really gel until airtime. So the Barbra Streisand thing did not seem to be as wonderful as it turned out to be. Not because the writing wasn't great, but because I didn't know how to imitate Barbra Streisand. I was like a Linda Ronstadt gal. So, you know, I was getting tips from the most unlikely sources. The guys in the band. I mean, I got it from the people in makeup, which I expected, but not the guys in the band. So it was, you know, it was things like that. You know, when Danny had left the show, we were doing another Bad Playhouse or Bad Something, which is usually hosted by his character, Leonard Pinth Garnell. And they gave me Lady Pinth Garnell, and I had just seen Murder on the Orient Express that day. So I thought, Wendy Hiller. So I went with that, and it worked. So, you know, I would point to those in the sense that I kind of came through when I didn't know that I could.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you had more shining moments than you think, because my sense is from listening to your memoir and talking to you now that your inner critic is very loud. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. And yeah. I think that the comments I've been getting from readers is that they related a lot. And I was determined to be honest about that, too, because to some extent, I felt it was shameful, the thoughts that I was having and the insecurity and the jealousy and the envy. You know, these are qualities that, you know, they're not particularly glamorous or attractive. But I had never read people talking about that in a memoir. And I just thought, damn it. It exists. It's part of human nature. And, you know, I'm going to fall on the sword and be the one, you know?
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you did, because that was one of the parts I could really relate to, because I have a very loud inner critic, actually probably more than one. So that way it's nice to know that it's comforting. It's like, you know, getting back to that question of how would things have been different if all the cast members had shared their feelings of fear and insecurity. It's good to know that we're kind of all... We're not as special as we think we are, kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 1989 was a really rough year for you. Gilda Radner died of ovarian cancer. And then 2 months later, your mother died of bone cancer. If you don't mind my asking, what was the last thing you said to your mother?
I said to her, I'm going to be fine. I'd been sober for like a year and a half. So she got to see me get sober, which I'm so thankful for. So that was really the last thing I said to her. And she said to me, it's dull to be good, isn't it? Oh, God. That broke my heart.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine it would, yeah. You've pivoted to a very successful second act with a career as a voice actor for animated films and TV.
Oh, that's Shelley Vernachek. Sad, really. Husband up and left her years ago. Now she sits at home playing solitaire on her iPad. She's internationally ranked as one of the loneliest women in the world. Biscotti?
How does voice acting compare to real-life acting in movies and on TV?
Well, you only have one instrument as opposed to your body and your face. And also just the interesting thing that happens when a camera transposes a scene that is framed. You know, there's something very different about photography and motion pictures, Doug.
You returned to SNL for the SNL 40th anniversary special, and you had an idea for one of the sketches. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I remember watching the Californians throughout the years and just thinking, ah, I would have loved to have been in that sketch. And then when I heard that there was going to be a 40th anniversary, I called Lorne and I said, you know, I don't know if you guys are going to be doing sketches, but I think it would be really fun to have Sherry as the matriarch, because a lot of soap operas have like the matriarch, to put that character in the sketch if you do it. And I didn't think anything would come of that. But then Fred Armisen called me and said, let's write something. So in my kitchen for several days, we laughed our asses off. And of course, nothing that we wrote ended up in the sketch, but we did have a lot of fun.
What's going on, you guys? You're being super loud. I was having a therapy session on the phone. He was giving me some real insights, but I almost didn't hear it because you guys were arguing.
It's a great sketch and a great idea on your part. And you had a great cast. Bradley Cooper, Taylor Swift, Betty White.
I know, yeah. It was great.
Yeah, so this time around, your SNL experience was a lot happier and more fulfilling, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we'd all grown up. It's like any kind of high school reunion. You know, as you go to the later ones, they're so much better because we've all kind of arrived at who we're going to be. And any kind of insecurity or resentments or fears or whatever have kind of gone by the wayside with maturity. And we're all just glad to be alive. And that kind of joy really informed the whole feeling of that show. Everybody was just so happy to see everyone.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Very well said. What is the most important thing you learned about yourself while working on your memoir?
That I can change. That I can overcome things, that preconceived notions I have about myself aren't set in stone. I always wanted to write this book for various reasons, which changed over the course of having written it. But I just never imagined that I could write a book. So that, I think, is really a major thing that I learned about myself, is that I could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lorraine Newman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Lorraine Newman is the author of the audio memoir, May You Live in Interesting Times. She's also an original cast member of Saturday Night Live and a voice actor for TV and film. Find out more about Lorraine at WPR.org/beta.
There was something kind of miraculous about the idea that these people all conspired to come together in an attempt to not let Aretha go so easily.
Writer Hanif Abdurraqib joins us to talk about the Black funeral and other kinds of Black performance in America. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I maybe find myself envious of Josephine Baker because she was unafraid to leave. She did not need a city or a country.
That's the poet, essayist, and cultural critic Hanif Abdurraqib reading an excerpt from his book, A Little Devil in America, Notes in Praise of Black Performance. In the book, he explores the pivotal roles that Black performers have played in American culture. Hanif examines the life of entertainer and civil rights activist Josephine Baker, the significant role that singer Mary Clayton's powerful voice played in the success of the Rolling Stones' iconic song, Gimme Shelter, and what makes the Black funeral different from other funerals. Hanif joins us from his home in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to Beta. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Doug. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. We just heard an excerpt from your book about the entertainer and civil rights activist Josephine Baker. And the title of your book, A Little Devil in America, comes from a speech she made at the March of Washington in 1963. Can you tell us a bit about this speech and what made it so powerful?
Yeah, it's a speech she gave kind of in the beginning part of the march. And, you know, it's a part of the march's history that I think is a bit under-remembered and under-glamorized. And the march's history is so male-centric, you know, but Josephine Baker spoke, and she was 57, which, of course, is not old, but it is much older than the crowd that knew her upon her leaving the States and perhaps had read about her performance exploits in France and beyond. I love the speech for how, it's funny, it's defiant, it's somber, but also celebratory. And there's a part of it where she kind of looks upon the younger audience and tells them to go and ask their grandparents about her, and their grandparents will tell them that she was a devil in other countries and a little devil in America too.
Mm-hmm. Josephine was born in St. Louis, Missouri, but she renounced her American citizenship and moved to Paris. During World War II, she joined the French resistance. What exactly did she do?
She was a spy and someone who kind of passed information along and traveled with information, because she could use her fame and notoriety, but also just her charm and her ability to kind of manipulate the desires of men in particular to shuttle information back and forth. And that to me is another fascinating and underreported part of her life.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit more about that, including why you think it's underreported?
Well, I mean, I think that it is a little bit more complex to approach Josephine Baker's fullness, and it is a lot easier for people to kind of confront her, the image of her on stage, and say a banana suit and the bikini of bananas, or you know, the picture where she's kind of making playful faces at a tiger, these kind of things. But in her mid to late life and career, there's still a lot of robust brilliance that is perhaps harder to confront, because she was operating in ways that are perhaps less glamorous to talk about.
And now let's run over and meet the toast of Europe.
It's nice to see you, and it's been a long time since you've been back on these shores, hasn't it?
No, only 2.5 years ago.
Well, of course, I'm thinking of the fact that originally you came from the United States.
Ah, yes, from St. Louis.
St. Louis, Missouri. Actually, St. Louis, Missouri at one time was French, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I thank you for remembering.
Well, you know, mostly I'm fascinated by what it is to return home and to have a complicated relationship with home, but still find yourself drawn to return to it. You know, I'm someone who loves where I live and was raised a great deal and have complications with it, but still love it. And there's an interesting push and pull that comes with, I think, being Black and loving any place in America. But I especially love Josephine Baker's relationship with St. Louis and her returns to America that were not without their complications and not without her, you know, comfortably voicing those complications.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite essays is called I Would Like to Give Mary Clayton Her Roses. For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with her, who is Mary Clayton?
Mary Clayton is a singer who is, I would say to most people, most notable for singing on the Rolling Stones song Gimme Shelter.
Can you take us back to the fall of 1969 when the Rolling Stones were working on the song that would become Gimme Shelter?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, kind of in the middle of the night, Mick Jagger, they decided that they needed a woman's voice to kind of sing through some of the chorus elements, a soulful voice, if you will. And the producer kind of got Mary Clayton out of bed, middle of the night, got her out of bed, you know, had her come down to the studio and sing, you know, What You Hear.
It's gonna shine. It's gonna shine. Whoa,
some would consider that she sings backup vocals, but I really think about Gimme Shelter as a Mary Clayton song, and of course it would later be a song that she sang on her own with no accompaniment from the Rolling Stones. But the most notable vocal part of her performance that I think people would recognize is the kind of build-up and repetition of the lyrics, rape, murder, it's just a shot away. And during, I think, the second or third rotation of singing that, on the second syllable of murder, her voice kind of reaches a really high point and then kind of cracks a bit. Hear Jagger giving kind of a shout of awe in the studio, which is on the final record. And it's funny because Mary Clayton was actually not the band's first choice for the part. They had asked Bonnie Bramlett to sing, and Bonnie Bramlett's husband would not let her sing with the Rolling Stones.
What thoughts go through your mind when you listen to Gimme Shelter?
Well, I have a hard time returning to it because it, for me, whether intentional or not, it does feel, I mean, the exertion in Mary Clayton's voice is jarring for me and hard to confront. I will say that her version, the version that it's just her singing, is actually my preferred version. That is my preferred version because I think, you know, it feels like she has more autonomy over the movements of the song and she's not being pushed to heights that suggest discomfort.
Mm, yeah. Can you talk a bit about the connection between Gimme Shelter and the disaster, the murder at Altamont?
Yeah. I mean, Meredith Hunter was a young black man who at Altamont during the Rolling Stones performance was murdered by a group of Hell's Angels in 1969. And he was young, he was 18. And when the Rolling Stones were performing, he kind of approached the stage and got perhaps too close to the stage. You know, he had, and by that time at Altamont, it must be said that just much was unraveling. You know, like the Hell's Angels became more intoxicated. The crowd became kind of restless and frustrated and also intoxicated. And Hell's Angels were also becoming more antagonistic towards the crowd. And by the time Meredith Hunter kind of got to the stage, the producer of Gimme Shelter, Porter Bibb, was begging, you know, kind of begging Meredith Hunter to calm down. But he was so enraged by the behavior of the Hell's Angels, but was also intoxicated. And he was murdered by the Hell's Angels. He, for his protection, he had carried a weapon to Altamont, or, you know, because of the racism in Alameda County. And he, like, brandished the weapon, and the Hell's Angels kind of descended on him and beat him mercilessly and then stabbed him to death.
There was the reality of the hurt and pain, the ardor, the ecstasy, the suffering, and the reality that we had to confront as a black people. And don't get it twisted, she was black without apology or excuse. And she was American without argument or exception. She was black because she was from the blackest city in the world, Detroit. I know y'all jealous, you from Chicago, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, you good, but you ain't got the D.
You have a very powerful essay about the unique experience of the black funeral. What makes a black funeral different from other funerals?
Well, I think at least I can only speak to the ones that I've been to. And, you know, I write an essay. I was raised going to two Muslim funerals before I went to any other funerals. And those experiences are vastly different than the traditional black funerals I've been to in, like, the South, or that I've witnessed if I'm thinking about Aretha Franklin's funeral. You know, there's just no concern for time or where anyone else might have to be. But there was something miraculous about that, to be present in the unfurling of that moment that seemed endless. You know, that day I turned on the funeral, Aretha's funeral, in the late morning, early afternoon. And I had to take a flight that day to be in Decatur. And I remember watching it on my phone as I got to the airport and the plane took off, and that flight's about an hour, maybe an hour, 20 minutes from Columbus. And I remember landing, getting off the plane, walking into the airport and realizing the funeral was not only still going, but it was just like maybe at that point just getting its legs, you know, just getting moving. And by the time I got to the hotel, you know, it was like an hour drive to the hotel and the funeral was still happening.
Wow.
You know, and there was something kind of miraculous about the idea that these people all conspired to come together in an attempt to not let Aretha go so easily.
Hmm. Yeah. When you were 21, you attended a funeral at a church in southern Alabama. Can you tell us about this experience?
I think that was maybe the first time I saw dance and song kind of collide in a way that was, that felt celebratory in the sense of grief. And not only dance and song, but like fashion too. You know, people wearing things that the deceased loved or wearing things that the deceased passed down to them, these kind of things, where the eulogy extends to a more physical space, a space of language still, but also a space that is really rooted in a celebration of the physical nature of what was left behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How has thinking and writing about Black funerals shaped the way you think about death?
Oh, I mean, I think, I've always thought about death with a level of, I think, a generosity and thoughtfulness and some level of gratitude. And so I don't know if, you know, the kind of thinking through the Black funeral has changed that. But I will say that, you know, it gives me a renewed sense of understanding that when someone is gone, there's still ways to keep them close to us. And there's still ways to fight to keep them alive in whatever ways we can. And there's also, you know, a big thing with me is that I realize that it is immensely important to not only look at grief and death and loss with sadness, but also to look at it with great gratitude for the fact that someone we love had a life that intersected with our own.
Mm, that's beautiful. That's very well said. You have this this really great essay about Soul Train in your book, and I wanted to ask you about the role that Soul Train has played in your life.
Oh yeah, I mean, weirdly, more now than ever. You know, I have this like hard drive of now I have a hard drive of every Soul Train episode from the 70s through the 90s. Hmm. You know, I have this archive of Soul Train performances that I am just always immersed in. And yeah, I mean, I grew up watching the reruns. And there's a difference, you know, like watching the reruns was great as a kid. But the thing with the reruns is you would get the commercials would be of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would kind of like pull you out of, you know, if you're watching a 1975 Soul Train rerun, but then the commercials for something from 1995, it's a different experience.
Yeah.
But with this kind of archive I have, the commercials are the commercials of the era. And it's incredible to me because I feel like I am really in the world of Soul Train as it's intended to be. And that has been really delightful.
Mm-hmm. We've had you on to talk about your love of A Tribe Called Quest. Now we've talked to you about the history of Black performance. What is next for you?
You know, I hesitate to mention this because it's so far down the road, but I am working on a basketball book, a book about LeBron James and high school basketball in Ohio and basketball movies and the idea of making it and who that idea serves. And it's funny, I mean, this is a book that I've always wanted to write and just could not figure out how to find my way to it. And now I kind of have the opportunity to, and I'm trying to take advantage of that.
Oh, very cool. We'll look forward to that. That sounds very, very interesting, amazing. Yeah. Hanif Abdurraqib, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here, Doug.
Hanif Abdurraqib is the author of A Little Devil in America, Notes and Praise of Black Performance. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Bill Oakley, Lorraine Newman, and Hanif Abdurraqib. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Attention Alphas! Join us for a virtual Beta Film Club on Thursday evening, April 22nd. Acclaimed author Matteo Escarapore will join us to talk about how great sales movies like The Wolf of Wall Street and Glengarry Glen Ross inspired his novel, Black Buck. For more information, visit wpr.org/presents. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
As hard as it is to believe, some people don't care for me neither.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He's in his office making a pathetic attempt to look professional.
And thanks to you, our Alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
This is my chance to show everyone how professional I am.